I'm going to explain in a second. Okay, so we've been taking things that, as I said, you all learned in kindergarten, but developing them and understanding them at a deeper level, learning some good lessons from them. What I'm going to do for the next 3 weeks is, and we're going to go for another 3 weeks, I'm going to take do the same thing, but take topics related to the High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which I think will be make it meaningful. And the reason we're starting today is a little early. We haven't even entered the month of Elul yet. The reason I'm doing that is because I can only go for another 3 weeks, because talking about being anxious of flying, so after that I actually am going overseas for a week, just before Rosh Hashanah for my nephew's wedding, which we're looking forward to. Just daven for me that I don't get stuck there for Rosh Hashanah. Sorry?
Where do you go?
New York. And I've left an extra day, so I should
you
get...
You say if you get stuck, that's how it's supposed
to be. You're not stuck, right? The Jew's not stuck, correct? Okay.
No control.
That's correct. They're exactly right. Although I am davening that I do make it back in time, because that's the plan. You're right. If that, you know, you're right. Okay. So, what we're going to do today, the topic we're going to do today is a topic actually... Really, it's a topic that got me started on this whole this idea of sort of taking ideas that people know but developing it so we should have a greater consciousness and awareness is my favorite topic of apple and honey. Apple and honey, everyone knows, I think this we can safely say that everyone learned in kindergarten that we have to dip apple and honey in Rosh Hashanah. It's a very widespread custom. Everyone does it. Why? Now, I have spoken, it's a bit of a giveaway, this, because I have spoken a little bit about it before, but we're going to take it deeper today. Anyone knows the basic reason why we dip an apple?
Sweet
New Year, of course. That's what they told you when you were 4 years old, and it's correct. And it's, as I said before, it's not incorrect, it's correct. It's pure, it's legitimate, it's authentic. But it's the reason that you get taught when you're very young, and there's much, much more to it. So, let's just go through a little bit of information first of all. It's interesting, where does the idea come from? So what I'm going to show you, it actually comes from a source in the Talmud. But funnily enough, the Talmud talks about lots of things we're supposed to eat on Rosh Hashanah. Some of them are becoming more popular, although it's not so widespread. In other words, what's very interesting, and this is a separate discussion really, but what's very interesting is that there are a few things that we eat on Rosh Hashanah night, which is a custom to eat, apple honey being sort of the most widespread probably, which has become a very widespread custom, but it's a custom which developed post-Talmudic times. I'll show you what I mean in a minute. Because we have a tradition in Jewish thinking that Jewish customs that were accepted by multitudes of communities have holiness to them. They don't just happen. They don't just happen in one community. So, yeah, nice idea, let's try and do it, and it has no meaning. In other words, there's a concept that our rabbis tell us, Minhag Yisrael Torahi, that a real Jewish custom, if it's legitimate and based on good things and based on good sources, and it's widely accepted, it becomes part of the Torah, and it also happens by Shulchan Pratit. There's a kind of almost collective prophecy that the Jewish nation have when they accept new customs. Now, new customs obviously don't take away from halachic observance and halachic principles, but they have tremendous depth. And One of the customs that is very widespread is this custom of apple and honey. Now, why do I say it's a custom? The concept of eating special foods in Rosh Hashanah comes from the Talmud. The Talmud tells us, Simana Miltahi, right? Simanim. What we eat on the Rosh Hashanah night is called Simanim. Signs, codes, right? And the Talmud says that when you, a code, a symbol is significant. Therefore, because a symbol is significant, the Talmud says that on Rosh Hashanah night, first night of Rosh Hashanah, one should eat foods that symbolize good things by their name. Okay. Now, what's the examples? As I said, some of these are becoming more fashionable again. By the Sephardi community, they've always been doing this. But there's some really interesting things. I don't even know what some of these things are. So, for example, you'll excuse me if I mispronounce this. One of them, the Talmud tells us, is you got to eat fenugreek.
Fenugreek.
What is fenugreek? What's that?
It's
a spice. Okay. So, why do you eat fenugreek? Because in Aramaic or in Hebrew, I don't know what it is in modern Hebrew, but in ancient Hebrew it was called rubia. And rubia comes from the word ribui, for to multiply. And we sort of eating that as a symbol to ask God that our zichuyot, our merits, our brownie points, so our good things that we've done throughout the year should be multiplied, and God should look at it abundantly. Is it?
Yeah, so it's the seeds that they usually eat, like the fenugreek seeds.
Exactly.
Okay,
so
there you are.
It comes in a long green shell. Yeah.
Right.
Sprouts.
Yeah, it might be the picture there, I don't know. The other thing, yeah, no, thank you. Is it called rubia in modern Hebrew as well? Rubia, okay, there you are. The name is stuck, that's really good. The other one the Talmud says we should eat is karti, which is leek. Now that's interesting, because the word karti has a different translation. It actually means to cut off. And there the wish that we do, or the prayer that we associate with eating leek, is that our enemies should be cut off from us, should be distanced from us. They shouldn't be able to affect us, right? It also tells us the same idea that we should eat silka, which is beetroots, right? Also, silka means to depart, that our enemies should depart, all these things. Then the Torah tells us we should eat, the Talmud says we should eat tamri, dates. Also, tamri comes, the word in Hebrew, yitamu, to finish. Also, that our enemies should finish, cease, right? These are all important things. Then there's an interesting one. We should eat kara. I don't know how you call it, modern Hebrew, but the same word, squash. What's squash in Hebrew?
Squash is lard. Yeah, but we'll say, I don't know, maybe it's my Moroccan mother, but we'll say kara.
Okay, well, there you are. Now, kara is an interesting word, because kara in Hebrew could be with an ayin, karak, which means to tear, same thing, that all our enemies and all our detractors should be torn away. But also, karak means should be proclaimed, like likra, to read, right? If you do it with an aleph. And there we are taught that idea that, again, our merits should be proclaimed before God. We should remember our merits and wish, grant us a good year and all that. So those are some of the things that the Talmud says. Now, again, in the Sephardic community, it's always been very common to do all of this. Ashkenazi community, not so much. They're kind of doing it now because it's become fashionable. A lot of Sephardi Ashkenazi integration happening post-war. But what Ashkenazi community traditionally do... Oh, we'll get to that in a second. Very good. Right? Is the head of a fish?
Sephardis do head of a
fish. Also, right?
Yeah,
but what I'm trying to say is that some of the other stuff too, but what I'm saying is that Ashkenazim do the things that developed sort of later as post-Talmud. So the head of the fish is two reasons. First of all, sorry, I hope I didn't freak anyone out here. So one of the ideas is to eat the head of any animal, because we should a head and not a tail. But also there's a concept of eating fish, and it's connected with something we did a few weeks ago. Fish, first of all, multiply a lot. Again, the idea of our merits and Jewish people multiplying and so on. Also, the fish, we are taught, is a symbol of protection from the ayin hara, from the evil eye. Because fish are the only animal that don't close their eye. Right? They sleep with their eye open. And that's the idea. Fish is always, also they're covered with the water, which is spiritual protection. And that's the idea of fish being a protection from ayin hara. That's why we kind of combine these two ideas, eat the head, but the head of a fish, because it's important to eat fish. There are some people, not too much nowadays, but it was more common in Sephardic communities, to eat the head of a ram.
Oh my God.
I once threatened at home that I might do that, and I was told it's either the ram or my wife, so I decided to not do it. But we never
nice
did it.
Choice.
No, the reason is it's very hard to get, so therefore people stop doing it. That's why they eat a head of a fish. Why the head of a ram? Because one of the things we do constantly on Rosh Hashanah is we remember the Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac. It was the supreme sacrifice, that supreme commitment that Avraham Avinu was prepared to do. And we use, and it gets a lot of mileage. We always ask God, particularly Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, to remember the Akedah and in the merit of our forefathers and their commitment and their self-sacrifice to grant us all good things, right? The other thing that's very, very common, I think it's fine to do this also, is to eat a pomegranate, a rimon. Why do we eat a pomegranate? Because, again, pomegranate has lots of seeds, the idea of abundance. But also a beautiful idea, the Talmud says, it's a reminder that, Talmud says it's based on a verse in Shir HaShirim that every person, no matter, you know, More committed, less committed, but at the end of the day, everyone's good. And everyone has lots of mitzvot. Everyone has lots of merits. So therefore, we ask God only to look at the good when it comes Rosh Hashanah and to count all the amazing amount of mitzvot and good things that, bottom line, everyone does. Everyone is engaged in good things. And therefore, we ask God to focus on that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Okay. And then, of course, the one that's really post-Talmud is this Tapuach Bedvash, the apple and the honey. So the question is why? Obviously, again, the simplest symbol idea is that sweet new year. But then, of course, the question is, why honey? Why an apple? What's the depth behind this custom? So I'm going to share with you a number of lessons. They're life lessons, not just Rosh Hashanah lessons, but they're important to remember and to reflect upon on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I've gathered these from various different Hasidic masters, Kabbalistic sources, that all go into and explore this custom of apple and honey. Again, this doesn't take away from the simple reason. Bottom line is, the simple reason is we ask God for a sweet new year, right? In fact, the prayer we say, when we dip the apple into the honey, we say, Yehi Ratzon, we ask God, may it be your will, Shetachadesh Aleinu, you should renew for us, Shana Tova Umetuka, a good and sweet year, right? That's the simple reason, and that's the true reason, but there's so much more to it to think about when we eat the apple and honey. And I'm sharing it with you, and hopefully you won't forget it by the time Rosh Hashanah comes, so you're able to remind yourself and reflect upon it when you eat the apple and the honey. So the first thing is just a general concept, and this comes from, I think I have mentioned this once before, but this comes from, I believe, the Gerer Rebbe, the Sfat Emet, one of the great Hasidic masters of the Hasidic sect called Ger. And I don't know what that means either, by the way. But it goes into the whole idea of why do we eat, what's this idea of simanim? Why do we eat foods that are called symbols or codes? Like, why? I mean, if you want to pray for a good year, pray for a good year. If you want to pray that God should cut off our enemies, let's do that. And we do that. Right? What's the idea of taking a food, which is something very physical, eating, and eating a food which has in it a symbol, right? By the way, there are other ones. This is really Ashkenazi, by the way. I just forgot that one. You mentioned it before. That Ashkenazi particularly eat carrots, tzimis. Yeah. Doesn't know what tzimis is, right? Yeah. Right. Now, this for me was a big deal because my mother used to make tzimis every single Friday night and I couldn't stand it. So I never ate the tzimis on Shabbos. However, it was a known thing and I was very compliant with the customs of Rosh Hashanah. My mother always knew that the one time of the year I would eat tzimis is Rosh Hashanah night. I would eat a little bit because that's the minhag, right? You got to do some things. You got to do things that are uncomfortable sometimes. But so why tzimis? Because in Yiddish, carrots is meren. Meren means to multiply. Same idea. So it became an Ashkenazi custom to eat things. Okay. What's this idea? So he said a very interesting thing. You know, on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, the whole New Year journey, not the whole month of Tishrei really, Shana, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and so on. There are two layers of themes that are happening at the same time, and I think there's an important perspective to develop in general, right? On the one hand, this is the year that sets the tone, this is the month that sets the tone for the year. We have a belief that this is the time that God grants us with a good year, and therefore, part of the theme of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is that we pray for a good year. We pray what's called Ketiva V'Chatima Tova. We pray to be sealed and to be written for a good and inscribed for a good and sweet year, all the blessings. And of course, we have full trust and faith that God will give us a good year, individually, collectively, and so on. That's one layer. And that's the theme of a lot of our tefillot, a lot of our prayers, right? All about, please, Zachreinu L'chai. We ask Avinu Malkeinu, we ask God to give us this, to give us that. We have a long list, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, Rosh Hashanah is also a time for reflection. You know, it's a time for tshuva. It's a time for us to recommit. It's a time for us to reflect on our life, on our values, on our connection to God, right, and so on. So the Sfat Emet says a very beautiful idea. He says, one of the things we need to reflect on, and we do this through eating these foods, and we call them simanim, codes. Why? To remember that whatever God is yes going to give us, and hopefully he will give us everything beautiful like sustenance and health and all material blessing that we all want and need. But our job, our commitment, our part of the deal so far is to remember that every blessing we have in essence is a code. It's a siman. In other words, the material blessings that we have are not the end in itself. The things that we have, the things that we enjoy, are really meant to be seen as a code to something deeper. And our job is to wake up in the morning and have all our blessings and to acknowledge our blessings and then say to ourselves, okay, but how can I use them? What's the soul? What's the soul of the food? Food just representing all the material blessings that we have. So what is it? What meaning and purpose can I achieve through the blessings that we have? Right? Am I making sense? Is that, yeah? And that's, he says, that's the depth of eating the simanim on Rosh Hashanah. Because yes, they're sweet, they represent good things, but they're also simanim. It's also a reminder for us that when God, please God, does bless us with all the good things, that we say to them, it's not, you know, the house, the food, the car, it's not just that. That's not the end in itself. That's not what life's all about. It's to use those things as a vehicle. There's a soul behind each blessing that we have. There's a purpose. There's a message. There's a code. And it's up to us to decode that throughout the year and to use the blessings that God gives us for something meaningful, for something purposeful. To help others, to be more spiritual, to be connected to God, and so on and so forth. So that's just a general, not just the apple and honey, that's a general thing. Whatever siman, whatever codes we eat on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, that's a reminder for us to view everything we have as a code, as a symbol. Okay. So why the apple and honey? Why the apple and why the honey? Let me just tell you a few interesting little things first. No, that's coming soon. Yes, we get this. So first of all, the word dvash in Hebrew, right? The word for honey is dvash. Right? Now we know that, you've heard this from me many times, in Hebrew every word has a numerical value.
How do you say wash in Yiddish?
That's dvash.
Dvash.
I can't hear the difference.
No, dvash. Like
D-V-A-S-H.
Dvash.
Vash.
And one is vash. And they're different languages anyways, yeah. So devash in Hebrew, which is three letters, has the same gematria, same numerical value as, like, why do we use honey for the sweet thing? Because devash has the same numerical value as Av Harachamim, the merciful father. It's a term we use in our prayers on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, right? Apple, on a very simple level, an apple is a fruit. You know, we have apples even on Pesach, right? We have the charoset we make with apples. So apples is a fruit which is a symbol of the Jewish nation. We know that when the Jews were in Egypt, we have the famous Midrash that Pharaoh decreed that all the babies should be thrown into the river. The men were almost sort of giving up. It says it was in the merit of the great women, actually, who enticed their husbands to keep going, to keep having children, even though they were in tremendous danger. And then when they would be ready to give birth, the Midrash says they would go off to the apple orchards and give birth there, and miraculously an angel would come and whisk the babies away and return them safely later to their parents. Now this is hinted in a verse in Tanakh, which King Solomon wrote, Shir HaShirim, in the Song of Songs, where God says to the Jewish people, Tachat HaTapuach Orartich, I awoke you, I gave birth to you under the apple trees. Right, so the birth of the Jewish nation, essentially in Egypt, was under the apple tree. That's why apple is one of the fruits that is a symbol of the Jewish nation. So I guess when you put apple and honey together, we're asking Av HaRachamim, the merciful father, to have mercy on his children, the Jewish nation who he gave birth to under the apple tree. Right, that's a kind of a symbol. Okay. Now, however, there's two deeper things about apple and honey. So we know that an apple, you're supposed to take a sweet apple, but apple is an interesting fruit. On the one hand, Kabbalistically, we know that apple has its source in the idea of chesed, right? Because sweetness comes from the idea of chesed. But what's interesting is an apple is not an amazingly sweet fruit. It's sweet, but there are sweeter fruits, right? Because we have an idea that sweetness, right? Sweetness can be hidden sometimes. The idea of chesed can be hidden. You know, we know this even as a parent to a child. Something, you do something to a child which the child doesn't perceive as being chesed, although you know that it is, right? it's for their good, or whatever the case is. So sometimes there's a concept that comes from God even, from which is chesed, we don't know why. Maybe it's for our good, maybe it's for our development, but it's not revealed sweetness. When you dip an apple into honey, what we're saying is that, you know, honey is a very sweet, clearly sweet, right? Because, you know, the term we use, right, is shana tova umetuka, a good and sweet year. What do we mean by a sweet year? What do we mean by that? Why don't we say a good year? Why just shana tova? I mean, sometimes we do. We say shana tova. We send shana tova cards, right? But we always add the word umetuka. It should be sweet. Because one of the things we have to emphasize in Rosh Hashanah is that we turn to God and we say, listen, it's hard for us. Sometimes, you know, we ask Him not to test us. We ask Him to give us a good year, but good is relative. Sometimes He gives us things which is not what we call revealed good. It might be good, it might come from chesed, it might have a certain sweetness to it, but we don't see it. Of course, we know that that happens, but we always pray that it shouldn't happen. So part of the emphasis on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is we ask God to give us shana tova, but umetuka. We ask Him to give us a good and sweet year, a year that we should feel its sweetness. We should be able to see it in a revealed way. What we call in the Hasidic classics, tov hanir'eh v'hanigleh. Good which is seen and revealed, right? Okay. But there's another thing, another very, very important thing. Something which we talked about a few weeks ago when we talked about salt. But here comes a very, very important concept when it comes to the whole idea of Rosh Hashanah as well, and also what we ask God to do and what we commit to do as well. Remember a few weeks ago we talked about the idea of mituk ha-gvurot, the sweetening of the gvura. We talked about the salt. Remember we said salt in itself is gvura, and if it's on its own it can be negative. But when you mix it with chesed, then the chesed becomes even stronger. So we know that honey is an interesting food. We mentioned this before. Honey actually does not have its source in chesed. Honey has its source in gvura. So honey comes from a bee. A bee is a stinging animal. Right? A bee, by definition, when you think of a bee, if you see a bee, what do? You run for your life because you don't want it to sting you. If you're like me. Other people don't. They know how to handle it better. But I'm saying, no one likes to get stung. Put it that way. Okay? So a sting is a concept of gevura. It's strength, but in an aggressive way. It's hurtful. Right? And yet it's the bee who produces honey. Another fascinating concept, which I'm sure you've heard me say before, but there's a whole discussion in the Talmud, actually, why honey is even kosher. Right? Because we have a principle in Jewish law that something that comes from a non-kosher animal is not kosher. Mm-hmm. Milk that comes from an egg that comes from an ostrich is not kosher. Milk that comes from a non-kosher animal is not kosher. Right? Milk must come from a cow or a goat. Right? So here we have something which we use on the first night of Rosh Hashanah at the height of the time where we're trying to become new ourselves and we're trying to ask God for a new fresh year of blessing and abundance and all kinds of wonderful things. And what do we choose for the sweetness? We choose something very sweet, but actually its origin is not even kosher. And it's stings. It comes from a stinging animal. By the way, in that discussion, there's a whole discussion because how the bee manufactures honey is different to how an animal produces milk and eggs and so on, so therefore it is kosher at the end, but it's still associated with a non-kosher animal, right? But the idea is as follows. The idea is, as we said a few weeks ago, number one, as far as God is concerned, what we ask Him to do, we ask Him actually not just to discard all the negative, we ask Him to turn the negative into positive. Because not just to give us chesed, but to mix into the chesed any potential gevura that was on its own and negative, to transform it and to mix it with the chesed. Because blessing that has within it gevura is a stronger blessing. We talked about this a few weeks ago. And that's one of the themes of Rosh Hashanah, the idea of sweetening and transforming the gevura. It's got to do, we'll talk about the shofar another time, but it's got to do with the shofar as well, because the shofar is associated with Yitzchak. We know that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov is chesed, gevura, and tiferet. Right? So also when you, we know that the day of Rosh Hashanah is actually called Yom Hadin. It's a day of judgment. In fact, it starts off, the day of Rosh Hashanah starts off with a theme of justice, with a theme of gevura actually. Because justice and gevura are synonymous. And yeah, part of the prayer and part of the whole thing we ask God is to turn it all around. Not to discard it, but to transform the Gevurah into Chesed, because when Gevurah is mixed and transformed into Chesed, it's an unbelievable flow of blessing. It's a very powerful flow of blessing. And that's why we use the concept of honey specifically. But it's not just what we're asking God to do. It's an important lesson for ourselves as well, right? Because as we said before, we come to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, hopefully with a upgraded commitment, right? That's part of the whole next month, starting the Shabbat, is the month of Elul. We have that month to prepare and to reflect and to hopefully come into the new year a little bit different. Now, part of being different, we know, is that we never get stuck in the past, right? Right? We know that. We talked about this when we talked about mindfulness and so on and so forth. But in Jewish thinking, we say about being present in the moment and worrying about today and how can I make today work, or, you know, letting the past go, which is all very, very important. We let the past go, but we don't discard the past. Right? In other words, when we reflect and we come into a new year, this is true always when we change, but particularly around this time of the year. We need to, even when we reflect and we identify weaknesses and failings and things like that nature, so yes, we don't get stuck in it. We should never let the past define going forward. Because if we get stuck in the past, we let the past define us, we never move forward. Moving forward means to let go. But let go doesn't mean to discard completely, because let go means not to let the past define you, but to let the past teach you. We must learn from our mistakes. Failings and mistakes and weaknesses play a role. They're not just accidents. They're not just not just failures in the system where we reset. Failures are important teachers. That's how God designed the human being. Right? That if we look past and we identify weaknesses, whether it's anger or jealousy or lack of spirituality, whatever our weaknesses are, we want to sort of improve, we need to reflect on that past. Let it go. Say, I'm going to let go. I'm not going to be stuck in the past. But I'm going to use the past to inform and to inspire and to teach the going forward. Right? And that's part of the idea of this power of honey. The idea of honey that we use in Rosh Hashanah. Because the honey doesn't have such good beginnings. It's a non-kosher animal. It's a stinging animal. And yet it's that stinging and that weakness or failing of that non-kosher past, so to speak, which actually we transform because we allow it, we allow it to teach us. We reflect on why did I fail? Or what is it that was hard for me? What can I do then? How can I learn from that mistake, right? What can I learn from that negative interaction I had with someone so to make sure next time my relationships are stronger? What can I learn about how I interacted with someone to make sure that my relationships are much more healthy in the future? And that's exactly the process of honey, of taking that stinging experience and turning it into sweetness. If we just forget about the past, which is okay, it's also good, as long as we don't get stuck in the past, but then the future becomes a bit more like the past, because we just keep on doing the same thing. You know, I once heard, I think I told you this, you relate to this, right? But what's the definition of an experienced teacher, right? Someone once said, this teacher is very experienced, they've been teaching for 30 years. Someone said, no, they haven't been teaching for 30 years. They've been doing the same thing for 30 years. Every year, the same way, right? Experience means you don't do the same thing. Experience means you look back at the year. This is true in teaching, it's true in parenting, it's true in everything. But it's true in life. You look back at the year and you say, what did I learn? What are the successes? Let's celebrate the successes. But more importantly, what wasn't the successes? We shouldn't be afraid of things that went wrong. Because those are the amazing teachings in life. Right, the best teachers are the things that went wrong, not the things that went right. Things that went right, we should cherish and we should celebrate, because it's good to identify the good, not just the bad. But we should also not be afraid of confronting failings and weaknesses from the past, because they inform the future. And that's the power of honey. It comes from a sting, but it's the most sweetest thing. And that's why we dip the apple into honey, showing that we take the hidden sweetness, we take the negative sometimes, and we turn it into complete sweetness. Okay, now, let's go to something even deeper. Right, which is the wrong festival, correct? No, but it's not. It's actually not. It's the Shavuot festival, but let's talk about it. Because, as we said, coming into the month of Elul, and coming into the journey of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, it's really about growth, right? So, growth and learning from the past and reconnecting on all levels. And that's about change. So this is the season, we're going to enter the season of change. That's the truth, right? Now, we're supposed to always change, but there are some times during the year where we have the energy of change is much more prevalent and much more emphasized. So when we talk about change, we need to understand how that works. And this is the amazing connection between the apple and the honey. So the Talmud tells us a very fascinating thing. Talmud tells us about the apple, first of all, that the Jewish people are compared to the apple. Why? The Talmud says that an apple tree is a strange tree, because apparently the apple tree, says the Talmud, is a tree that every other tree, the leaves grow before the fruit, and the apple tree, the fruit grows before the leaves. Now, I will mention that it's not so simple. If you look at an apple tree, you might actually not see that. And there's a great commentary in the Talmud, the Tosfot. Actually, this is talking about 12th, 13th century stuff that addresses actually what the Talmud means, because it might not actually translate into actuality, that concept. And there is a suggestion that actually it's not a reference to the apple. It's a reference actually to the etrog tree, which is sometimes referred to as an apple. Right? Now, we don't have etrog trees to eat on Rosh Hashanah. So we eat that fruit, which is representative of the etrog tree. Okay, but it's called a tapuach anyway, whatever the case is. It's a symbol of this concept. It's a symbol of a tree, whether it's the actual apple tree or a different tree, but it's a symbol of the tree that the leaves grow, the fruit grows before the leaves. Right? Just wanted to bring that in, otherwise I might get, someone might tell me that they know how apple trees grow and it doesn't quite work like it, which is fine. So the Talmud says that what's it going to do with the Jewish nation? The Jewish nation also did something sort of out of order, or seemingly out of order. The Jewish nation prefaced the Na'aseh before the Nishma, right? A famous idea, wasn't that? This is talking about the time of Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, that the Jewish nation, when God said, I want to give you the Torah, they didn't say, let us explore it, let us understand it first, which is the idea of Nishma, let us hear. Explain the product. They didn't say that. They said, Naaseh, we're going to do, we commit. And then afterwards, Vinishma. Okay. So it's similar to the sort of apple tree that it's like kind of seems out of order. In other words, just like the fruit is there before, they jump in. Fruit is there right away, before the leaves, before building the structure, we're already there. Okay, so that's why the Jewish people are compared to Naaseh Vinishma. On the other hand, if you go back to the whole concept of Naaseh Vinishma, you'll notice a very interesting thing. And I'm going to translate this into how we live our life in general. When the Jews said Naaseh v'nishma, it was considered amazing, right? They committed without even understanding. But they didn't just say Naaseh, we're going to do it. They didn't just commit. They did say they're going to understand, just they're first going to commit. Which seems to suggest that understanding is really important, just after the commitment. So when we eat the apple and honey, the apple is a symbol of commitment. The honey is a symbol of understanding. Why? Because the honey is sweet. The honey is, you can understand. In fact, somewhere in Tanakh, the Torah, which is all about understanding and learning and information and education, is compared to honey. Right? It's compared to milk and honey, which are nourishing things. When you taste something, is when you can really taste the sweetness, that's when, because you've learned, you've understood. Right? So, we have this idea that comes like this. And this is part of the foundations of going into Rosh Hashanah. That if we want to grow as people, we need both things, right? Both things are critical, right? Commitment and understanding, but in that order. And let's understand why. Part of the, we discussed this a while ago, but part of the ingredients of growth, true growth, right, in a Jewish context, is the idea to grow beyond ourselves. Which means, and in the Jewish context, it means that we are given a gift that we can engage in something which is beyond us. When I say beyond us, means that it might not be even something we understand, right? I gave a you might have picked up, I'm a bit into this at the moment, because I gave a lecture, we discussed it when we did Brené Brown a little bit, but I gave a lecture one night in someone's house lately called Freud, Viktor Frankl, and Brené Brown. I don't know if you saw it advertised, but looking at three models and three generations of therapy, right? I didn't mean those particular names necessarily, but what I brought out was the following. In Freudian psychology, the functioning of the human being, according to Freud, is based on the pleasure principle, essentially, without going into all the, right? So people are born to have pleasure. Yeah, then as we mature, we have certain mechanisms to regulate that pleasure so we don't get into trouble, that we don't destroy society, that we have able to some semblance of morality and so on and so forth. But essentially, I mean, Freud, as we know, was against, I mean, he was the father of modern psychology, and great stuff, but he was not very religion-orientated at all, nor not very spiritual. In fact, he viewed religion as a crutch, and he was very anti-religion. But he just said the human being is basically a pleasure monkey sort of, you know, kind of being, and we do everything for ourselves. Okay. Then came the next generation, which was Viktor Frankl, positive psychology, and others, which became much more in line with Jewish thinking, much more into meaning, much more into purpose, in different ways, but much more into being selfless, about not being egocentric, about, no, a person has a capacity to live a life of meaning. Viktor Frankl says that at the heart of every single person is the, at the core of every human being is the pursuit of meaning, of not just what I can do for my own benefit, my own pleasure, but what can I do for, to make the world a better place, to bring meaning, right? The idea of I don't know if you remember, we did a whole series on Hugh Mackay's book on A Good Life, which is that true happiness only comes from living a life of meaning and so on and so forth. Which was a generation that, I mean, Viktor Frankl was amazing, and later obviously the works of Edith Eger and so on, right, was amazing about taking away victimhood and taking away focus on self and being able to be so resilient because there's a higher purpose, there's something greater than ourselves, and there's something that we can withstand so much challenge because there's meaning at the end, right? That was all Viktor Frankl's sort of legacy. And then comes very modern stuff. And I've said this to you before, and I really believe this, that although there's a lot of good stuff happening today, but I fear very dangerously that there's a shift going back. There's a shift to a very, very self world, right? A very, very self world. It's very troubling, I have to say. And it's all clothed and obviously often put in the terminology of good stuff. And it's very dangerous. And one has to sift the good from the bad. Because we're going back to a very me world, a very I world, where people are only willing to engage in things that are good for them, that work for them, that talk to them, that they understand, that relates to them. Right? Now, the reason I bring this up is because, particularly from a Jewish perspective, this is terrible and it's very dangerous. I think it's dangerous generally because we're creating a generation of victims and needy people and people just very self-centered, which is very, very, I mean, it's for a much longer talk, but it's a problem. Which goes back to the Na'aseh V'Nishma principle. You see, Judaism teaches us that, no, you've got to be ready to commit. And commit means to commit to something that even doesn't talk to you. Because if it's something, you only engage in something that works with you, and it could even be spirituality, by the way. Spirituality could even be a form of self-expression. Some people say, I I'm not into the physical so much, I'm more into spiritual. Now, spirituality is definitely better than materialism, but spirituality can also be just a form of self. If that's the only thing, I'm ready to engage in the spirituality that I, right? And Judaism says, no, obviously spirituality is very important in Judaism. But Judaism says that's why we have certain things, we've talked about this before, where God tells us that real growth comes from committing to doing things, which maybe don't even talk to us, which we don't even understand. God says there's certain mitzvot, as we know, we talked about this before, that which are called chukim, statutes. God gives us mitzvot without even reasons. He says, because you've got to engage, you've got to commit. Because when you commit, that means you're committing beyond yourself, completely yourself. You're committing to something greater than yourself. Committing to God, and from a Jewish perspective, of course, right? At the same time, God says, but I want you to try and understand as much as you can. Your foundation has to be commitment. Foundation has to be selflessness, not yourself. But I want you to understand as much as you can. Why? Because understanding is very important for two reasons. First of all, if you don't understand as much as you can what you do, let's say I commit to doing something but I never understand it, sometimes it's not sustainable because you don't have passion for it, because understanding brings passion, brings excitement. And also God says, I want the whole of you to be involved. You see, if I do something that I don't understand, on the one hand, it's fantastic, it's great, it's real commitment. On the other hand, I'm only doing it with my power of doing. My heart's not there, my brain's not there. And God says, I want every part of you, right? So that's apple and honey. And that's why when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, maybe starting from Rosh Hashanah even, right? A good way to go into a new year is with a double layer of growth. To commit to commitment, to take something that maybe I don't really understand or I'm not really excited about, but I'm going to do it because I think it's right. But at the same time, to commit to education, to commit to learning, to commit to understanding. And then it's sustainable and then it lasts. It's interesting also that the apple and honey represent commitment and understanding. But it's also how it works in terms of apple and honey. An apple is a fruit that if you don't, it's very sweet. But if you buy it from this fruit store, you leave it for a few days, it's going to go rotten. Honey is a preservative. Honey makes things last. So to that idea, when you eat the apple and honey, just to reflect on what can I do to this going into a new year, to actually take upon myself something maybe I didn't do before. But maybe it's talk to someone and engage in someone who I can't stand. Maybe it's a relationship that I'm just not interested in doing, but I mean, I need to call that person anyway and say, wish them a good year, even though I really don't feel like it. Commitment. Maybe it's a mitzvah. Maybe it's something. Maybe it's both. But it needs to be something where we commit. At the same time, we have to commit to learn. Because we know the secret to Jewish continuity is education. We've talked about this many times. The honey. The honey is important. The apple alone is not good enough. The apple has to come before the honey, because the apple is that symbol of naaseh, the symbol of commitment. But it's got to be dipped in honey. It's got to be a commitment to, yes, commit, but then not to be wrapped in myself. We've got to say, I'm prepared to go beyond myself. I'm prepared to grow beyond myself. Not always to say, well, if it doesn't talk to me, it doesn't feel right, I'm not doing it. No, I will, because it's the right thing to do, because I'm going to grow beyond myself. I'm going to commit beyond myself. That's the idea of selflessness, because my goal is meaning, not self. But at the same time, to want to understand and to explore knowledge and to really try and to internalize and to gain sweetness and taste in everything that we do. I'm just going to finish off. We're not going to have time for the last. Maybe I'll think of the last time, but thinking of Rachel and Leah, which is important. Maybe we'll do it next week. But I just want to mention on that level, we're launching a lot of stuff throughout the month of Elul, and actually Rosh Hashanah as well. So please read all the emails and the WhatsApps and lots of opportunity to commit and engage. I'm going to run off. Sorry for being rude.